verse 2 and 3. And the verse 2 says that a good person brings out the will of God, and a man of evil devices will be condemned. All right, that's verse base. Verse 2. Verse 3 says a wicked man will not stand firm, and the root of the righteous will not be moved. Question is what is a good person in relationship to a righteous person or a wise person? What does it mean by good? By a good person. Question is, what is the will of God? By a man of wicked devices. Mean that he will condemn. What does that mean? In other words, what happens? The question is that if you obtain the will of God, how do you know when you have obtained the will of God? The question is how does a good person, that doesn't explain how to, what good person brings out the will of God. He's just saying that the good person brings out the will of God. But we would like to know how he does it so we could do it also. What does it mean that he won't be firmly established? Established in what? In what way? And what's the root of the righteous? What does it mean by the root of the righteous? What does that mean? And what do you mean it will not be moved? I mean, it hardly makes any sense at all. The question is what does it mean by a root? Because a root usually means a root of a plant, and it's it seems to be the basic or foundation of the plant. It supports the plant. So, well, how does that work here? Okay, what is the root? How does the comparison of the root of a plant work with the root of a tzaddik, of a righteous person? All these questions, we realize we don't understand the whole verse, both verses. What we have to understand is, what is the will of God? Okay? And the real problem is like this. We really cannot understand who God is. We cannot know what God is. We cannot know anything about God. So therefore, we cannot know what the will of God is. So what does it mean? Because the will of God, it must be bound up with God. So the question is, what does it mean by the will of God? The last question is that since we're talking about the will of God, that means it's something that God wants. Now, we cannot say what God wants, because once you say what God wants, then you're saying something about God. So then how could you know what God wants or the will of God if you can't know anything about God? Like halacha, that we're obligated to do. Now, aren't we doing the will of God what God wants when we're doing halacha? Because God commanded us, so it must be something he wants. So don't we know something about God? In other words, so there again we're saying that we know something about God, when in reality the part of the 13 basic principles of our faith is that we can't know anything about God. Let's say, for instance, the suggestion was, is that let's say somebody wants a Jeep, okay? That's all you know, he wants to buy a Jeep. Then what do you know about the person? Do you know anything about the person? The answer is yes, I do know something about the person. I know that he has a desire for a Jeep. I might not know why he has this desire, but I do know something about the person that he wants a Jeep. In fact, every predicate of every statement of any subject tells me information about the subject. The problem is, whenever we have any predicate of God, since we cannot know anything of God, so then how could you say any predicate of God? And yet the Torah constantly uses predicates of God. God's vengeance, God's anger, God is merciful, all these type of things. So it is telling us something about God and yet we know that we can't know anything about God. That is really what the problem is. How could we know anything? How could we know that we cannot know anything about God? How could we know that? That is a, insofar as Torah is concerned, that is one of the 13 basic principles of faith. There are certain, like Maimonides and others like him, try to explain and show from the universe to prove that we cannot know anything about God. But we, insofar as our discussion here, we're accepting the premise of Torah, that the Torah tells us that we cannot know anything about God without proof. We're not going into any proofs about God or anything like that. But we're accepting the premise that we cannot know anything about God, and we're asking the question about, on this verse, where it's saying the will of God, then we do know something. We see that God wants something. If it's his will, it must be something he wants. So therefore, we know something about God. That is the problem. Answer to this question will also, we'll try to answer wherever it talks about a quality of God, what it means, or any information about God. So let's ask, if we don't know anything about God, how are we supposed to know that we're supposed to do God's will? Because we don't know anything about God. Somebody made a comment that we're at point zero. In other words, we don't understand the will of God, and therefore we have nothing. The real truth is that we do have knowledge. Because before we thought we could know something about God. Now we see that we can't know about God, and we have a problem and a question what the Torah means. So therefore we know that the information that we had before is false. So therefore we have more knowledge than we had before. Because before we had false knowledge, and we thought we had knowledge, which we really didn't. Now we have true knowledge that what we had before is really not true. So therefore we really have knowledge. If a person has an answer that is false about God, so then he is lying for God. He's just lying for God, trying to find excuses for God. But so therefore, he really doesn't have the truth. But however, if you realize you don't that the knowledge that you have of God is not true, so then you do have knowledge, which means you're also closer to God. Because as you gain truth, then you get closer to God. So when you have the question, so then you are actually closer to God than a person that tries to give excuses for God or to give false answers for God. Is that when the Torah speaks about God, then it must be speaking about God allegorically. That is correct. Okay? That we defined an allegory or a metaphor as one quality of the whole total subject. In other words, one quality about God. Okay? Now the question is, what is that quality? What we can know about the will of God is the effects of the will of God. In other words, if I have a desire, like we said before, if I have a desire for a Jeep, so I know my desire, or you will know my desire, when I say I would like to buy a Jeep. That's how you know. Okay? But since about God we cannot know who he is, or any quality about him, but we can know the results of that will, even though we don't know what his will is, but we know the results of his will. Okay? The results of God's will is the creation of the world and the Torah. All these things are what God did do. The results. So we can see God's results, and we can understand the results of his will, but we don't know what his will is. In other words, in any science, when you start, like, let's say, for instance, you're studying medicine. So first you get the symptoms. In other words, you see a disease, you see the symptoms, but you don't know the cause of the symptoms, but you know there has to be a cause, so you search for the cause. In this case, in God, you can only understand the symptoms, but you can't understand the cause of the symptoms, namely, why God did it. See, in this world, and everything we read in Torah is a result of God's will, right? Because God created it. So therefore, that's all the... when we talk about the will of God, we're talking about what we talk about is what we see. We don't know why God does anything. We don't understand it. In fact, as you study about the universe, King David asked the question, what is man that God should even deal with him? Well, I mean, he can't understand it. That's a question you can't answer, because you would have to understand God. Why would he even bother with such a with anything physical? Because the physical world is you see, it's a weak thing. Things die, but things just break down. I mean, all these things, this constant change, which shows that it wasn't the same as before. All these type of things shows that it's a weakness. Why should God deal? God, who is the ultimate perfection and is perfect, why should he deal with such a weak world? You see? That we can't answer, because to answer that question, we'd have to understand the nature of God. All we do see is that God created it. That's all we know. That's the only thing we know. So therefore, when we want to know the will of God, all we could know is the results of that will. And that means his creation and his Torah. The same question, basically, when it states in the Torah about the 13 qualities of God. Okay, there are 13 qualities about God, that he takes time for him to get angry, and he's merciful, and he's kind. So the Maimonides asked the question, how could the Torah say that there are 13 qualities about God, since we cannot know who God is? So he answers like this. He says, let's take fire, okay? I'm sorry, the question was slightly different. The question was, if we know that God is only one, he asked the question slightly differently than us, but it would help us also. He asked the question, if we know that God is one, that we say in the Shema, right, every day, that we have to know that God is one, then how could that one equal to the 13 qualities? Okay? I mean, if it's one, it's one. If it's 13, it's 13. Which one is it? You see, it can't be both. This question is, what he said was that when you see fire, let's say fire, right? Now, when fire touches, let's say wood or paper, so what happens to it? It becomes charred, it becomes burnt, right? When fire is under a pot of water, right? What happens to the water? The water evaporates, right? And now at times we could ask, what happens when you put the fire to gunpowder or firecracker? It explodes. Now, does that mean there are different qualities about fire? Or there's only one quality in fire, but it shows up in different ways? You're going to have to say that fire, in different situations, shows up differently. Now, we don't understand the essence, but we know somehow this essence in the physical world somehow shows up differently in different things. Again, Maimonides does not explain who God is, but he removes the contradiction of we say that God is one, and simultaneously we say that he has 13 qualities, which means there's 13 parts to him. So what he answers is that no, the effects of God in the physical world show up in different situations differently. But however, it's still the same essence that is affecting it. And that essence, we cannot know. We cannot understand what it is at all. The question is, if we can only know the effects of God's will, but we cannot know God's will, we cannot know why he wants things, so why doesn't the Torah write that way? So people shouldn't make mistakes. Why not write that way? That just writes the effects of God. The effects of God, there are 13 effects of God. Instead of saying, like, 13 qualities, say there are 13 effects. And in the other things, Instead of using the allegory that God gets angry, whatever anger means, say it in that way. Okay? Next question. The answer to that question is like this. Einstein one time, somebody wrote a book about Einstein's theory of relativity. And Einstein wrote an introduction to that book. Okay? He says, in the libraries, he says, there are many, many books that are written for people that do not have knowledge of science. They're written for the public so they could have some knowledge of science. He says, in most of those books, there's one of two problems. Okay? He says, one problem is that they don't want to lose the essence, so they have to be scientific to a certain extent, which again loses the public reader. He loses the reader. Okay? And then he says, and some people write it, they want to make sure they get it across, they write it so superficially that they're getting the wrong idea. He says, if you remove all the books for the public that have these two faults from the library, he says there'd only be a very, very few books, like not even a shelf of books that the public could be able to understand and get the true essence. Okay? Now, the Torah was written for the Torah, a five-year-old could read the biblical stories, you see, and the greatest thinker, the abstract sages, read the same book, you see. So what God did, he wrote it in such a way that everybody could relate to it, but yet it's written in such a way that the thinker would be able to abstract all these concepts that we're talking about now. So therefore, that's the way the Torah was written. It was written for the beginner, that the beginner could sit down and read it and relate to it. And as he gets knowledge, his understanding of Torah changes. His understanding of the words, his understanding of the meaning changes, and it becomes more in depth. So every person could understand Torah on his level and relate to God on his level of understanding. Involved with the results and the understanding of the results, what's going to happen is that you're going to have to be very, very abstract mind to do it. The book would be closed to most people. They wouldn't even bother. So therefore, it was written in such a way that every human being could relate to it on their level, and as they develop in their thought and understanding, so they're able to understand it at a much deeper level. The question is that there are a lot of people that will read the book and will not go into the depth, and therefore they'll have a false view of God. The answer is that's true. That's why the Torah advocates that you must be an abstract thinker. You see? You must learn how to think. If you study Talmud, you'll see Talmud is a study that is going to train the mind. In fact, Maimonides says that's one of the purposes of Talmud, of law, of Jewish law. One of the purposes of halacha is simply to train the mind how to think. Because to relate to God, you must have knowledge. And so therefore, if you're not going to have the knowledge and he's going to write the truth, and you're not going to really understand the truth, and it's going to be for very few people. And also, if he just writes it, so first of all, certain people won't understand it, and other people, they'll just accept what he says without really understanding it, because they didn't get involved in analysis of it. Go back to one statement that we made before. And that is that the person that has a question and doesn't have an answer is closer to God than the person that has given a false answer, is because you see from the question what it has evolved is a new understanding of God and a new understanding of your relationship and how to relate to God. So therefore, you can't be afraid of the questions, because that brings you closer for two reasons. One, because you're honest, and God relates to honesty more than to falsehood. He doesn't relate to falsehood. So the thing is, that's one reason. So even the question itself is inherently closer to God. And two is if you're an honest thinker and you keep working on it, then you will find an answer, you see? And that answer will show you the false view that you had before and the true view. And that true view is definitely will bring you closer to God. So in two ways, the question brings you closer to God. One, inherently it makes you closer to God because you're involved with the truth. And two is that the results of that honesty, the results of that honesty will give you knowledge that will definitely bring you closer to God. We're doing chapter 12, and we're going to do verse 5, 6, and 7. And what they say is verse 5 says, the thoughts of the righteous are justice, okay? Righteous are justice, but the counsel of the wicked are deceit. Okay, now verse 6, the words of the wicked are to lie in wait for blood, but the mouth of the upright shall deliver them. Okay, verse 7, the wicked are overthrown and are no more, but the house of the righteous shall stand. Okay, that's it. What are the questions? The question is that the thoughts of the righteous only justice? Aren't there other thoughts in the mind of the righteous? Is that we're talking about thoughts, and why doesn't it mention his actions? If his actions are correct, then definitely his thoughts would be correct. Definitely he should carry it out in action. Why does it only mention the thoughts? Is that... the contrast between the first half of the verse and the second half of the verse. The first half of the verse talks about the thoughts, and the second half talks about the counsel of the wicked, which seems to be that they're actually speaking and discussing things, which seems to be slightly different. So what's the comparison between the two? And the mouth of the righteous will save them. Who's the them? Seems to be that the verse is saying that it's axiomatic that a person will ambush for blood. Now, that doesn't seem to be true. Okay, it doesn't seem to follow. By mouth of the righteous. Is that it says that the wicked are overthrown and they are no more. Okay, and the question is we don't necessarily see that. Where does the house of the righteous come in? Suddenly we're dealing with the house of the righteous. Well, what is this house of the righteous? Not necessarily do we always see that the righteous stand. What is the theme between all these three? What's the theme? Since they seem to be connected, so what is the theme of all three? The thing is that the thoughts of the righteous are just. You have to understand that justice is a result of your knowledge of God. If you do not have, when we talk about justice, we talk about, especially when we're talking about the tzaddik, the source of his justice is knowledge of God. So therefore, when we talk about justice, it's not a particular area of thought. It's since it's bound up with his relationship to God, it's a very, very basic foundation of his thoughts is to think about justice and how to carry it out. Okay? So that's very basic to the righteous. Question of the contrast between the first half of the verse and the second half of the verse is that, you see, they're really contrasting the righteous in their relationship to society. So their very thoughts is always to benefit and to help society. While the wicked, all their thoughts is for deceit. In other words, we're not talking about a person that does an act of evil like, you know, on the spur of the moment. We're talking about a person that has a plan and works out a plan. He has a whole plan of working out his evil, but the purpose of his plan is always to, for deceit, meaning that for money or for gain, for some type of gain, at the expense of others. Like, he doesn't think of others, he only thinks of himself. So therefore, all his planning is because he's only very selfish, so therefore he doesn't think of the other person. The other person, he looks at the wayside. So he tries to get his gain through others. Righteous, his relationship to others is always to benefit them. Others deals with thoughts. Okay? And where the thought, the difference between the righteous and the wicked, where the thought processes go. The second one deals with words. Okay? Now, verse 6 is dealing with if the first stage fails. In other words, let's say he's out to make money. And he makes all types of trickery and all types of deceit. And all types of plans to gain the money, and it doesn't work. So then he goes to the next stage, and the next stage is simply ambush them and kill them and take away the money. In other words, if deceit doesn't work, then the next thing is murder. Is that the verses seem to jump from working on success to murder, okay? And the question is, I mean, there's a lot of other things. Sometimes people, if they don't get their way, they slander the other person, they gossip about them. I mean, people don't necessarily go to murder. Okay? That's the question. The answer is that the Proverbs talks about the ultimate evil. There are what we would call mediocrity. Okay? Mediocrity evil. In other words, where, for some reason, their emotions won't allow them to carry out all their evil. So therefore, we don't deal with that because they're stopped by their own emotions. We're talking about a person that could relate to reality with his total evil in a total evil way. We're talking, in this case, like the mafia. Okay, the mafia is everything is business. And even when they murder, it's only business, you see? So, but most people have the desire, in other words, if they're not successful, to do away with another person or somehow get rid of them. But the thing is that their emotions won't allow them to carry it out. And in many cases, they won't even allow their emotions won't even allow them to see that they have such a desire. And many times, if they do carry it out, they carry it out with all types of rationalizations, like the Inquisition. The Inquisition carried out murder with all types of rationalizations. So you see that the desire is there, but emotions stop the person from carrying it out. We're not talking about where the emotions stop you. We're talking about the ultimate evil where they carry it out. It seems to deal with the person that's totally righteous, that's totally guided by justice, and a person that's totally evil will allow his evil emotions to be totally carried out to the wherever it's necessary to get his ends. He'll do anything to get his ends. This is that mediocrity. What are the consequences of mediocrity? Well, first of all, the consequences of mediocrity, they will not be totally satisfied, since, in other words, inherently they're not going to be satisfied because they're in conflict. They want something and they can't have it. What they do is daydream about it, okay? Or go to movies to carry out their desires, okay? But they can't actually live it. So they're definitely not happy. And two, they fail because since they're not thinkers in their everyday life, they make mistakes. In raising their children, they have conflicts with their children, and they have conflicts with the society around them. I mean, it's constant, and they don't know how to protect themselves when bad things happen. They don't know how to protect themselves. The righteous know how to protect themselves. But however, the mediocrity who's not guided by thought, so he has neither success in the physical, real success. You know, the ultimate success, what the emotions really desire, and he doesn't really realize. In other words, basically, what happens to mediocrity He's really a product of his society. If his society happens to be successful, he'll be successful. Society is a failure, so then he'll fail. He can't get above either way. See, while the righteous and the wicked, the ultimate wicked, they're the cause of the life around them. They make decisions. While mediocrity doesn't really make decisions, they're really controlled by society. Whatever society, it's like a herd mentality. Person is guided totally by a plan. He has a plan. He has an objective. It's not where it's just like a haphazard in a moment of passion. I don't say he will not act on passion, because he has a lot of passion, but basically his life is guided by a certain plan for wealth and success, and it's based on that, you see? But however, the mediocrity is just, you know, in a moment they do this, either they follow society, or in some moment they suddenly jump out of the ways of society and they do an act that like O.J. Simpson. Like that murder was not, I don't think it was like planned out like an evil thing, even if he did think about it beforehand. But however, the thing is, it was a moment of passion. It was a moment of passion. It wasn't the way of life. See, evil means it's a total way of life, a total thought out plan. You see? This was only a particular situation where his passion took over. He might have planned it based on that passion, but it wasn't a plan in life. The evil person has a whole philosophy of life. Like Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, it shows his philosophy. He has a philosophy in life. You see? That's what we're talking about. An evil person has a plan in life and about life. It's not just a haphazard thing. But it's based on his passion and his desires. Is that we send our children to college to gain an education, and that's to make money? I mean, isn't that would that be considered evil? The answer is that if a person has greed, and he allows that greed to continue, then yes, that going to college could become an evil thing. It could benefit him in his evil. But however, if a person goes to college because it's a practical thing, that's the way we make a living in our society. We need a college education to make a living. So then it's a practical thing. Then it's not an evil. Then it's practical. Really, the truth is all physical things in the world is neither evil or good. It's how the human uses it that makes it evil or good. The thing is that that somebody mentioned that at some point the person has to make a decision that he's going to be evil. I think that's right in the case of the Russia, the evil person. But however, in terms of mediocrity, I don't think they ever thought it through. I don't think they ever made a decision. I don't think they used their free will. I don't think they brought their free will into usage. However, the ultimate wicked person and the ultimate righteous, they make the decision that they're going to live a certain type of life. The observation that was made, that it seems like the wicked person doesn't think about tomorrow, but however, the righteous does plan for tomorrow, okay? The truth is, in a way you're right, in a way it's not right. Because the wicked person, his whole purpose is to make, let's say, like the mafia, is to make money. Okay? So therefore, it's always in the future what he's going to make. What he made now doesn't really satisfy him, so he has to work harder to get more money. So he's always living in the future. While the righteous, even though he makes plans for the future, and he looks through for the consequences of all his actions, he looks to enjoy life right now. In other words, through his studies and through his understanding of life, and even the everyday simple things, he's aware of the simple pleasures that are out there and that are there for the taking, that every human being could have in every day. I mean, you sit out in the sun. They say about that Alexander the Great had a friend that was a philosopher. I forgot his name. And Alexander the Great asked him, is there anything I could give you? Could you imagine if Alexander the Great offered you anything you wanted? You know? I mean, all the things that you would ask for. He said, I would appreciate it if you move out of the sun because you're blocking the sun. That's all he wanted was the simple pleasures of life. That's it. This is, what about the life after death? Doesn't the righteous think about the life after death? The answer is he thinks about life after death as a knowledge, as an idea. You see? But the people that live for life after death, for the good life, is because they're not happy here. Because they're unhappy, so they have to wish for the future. And they have to try to be satisfied that I will have it. I don't have it now, but I will have it. That's really the wicked person, that he's not satisfied now. The righteous are very satisfied now. They don't have conflicts. Basically, they work out their lives and in a good way, so they have a very good life. They do know that living the good life, they will have a reward in the future. But however, in a certain way, they really live for the present, for the enjoyments of the present. But they realize the consequences of incorrect action, so they avoid it. You see? Later on, they avoid incorrect action simply because it's unjust to do incorrect action. So therefore, again, it becomes the present to a certain extent. So the thing is that you see that the righteous really live in the present and enjoy the present right now. And when he lived, the reason why he's successful is because he's living correctly in this world. This world is based upon a system, and once you learn how to live in that system, then the results are all good. But he doesn't worry about the results, he just tries to live in line with God's will. Once you live in line with God's will, then everything works out. But however, if you're only looking for the future, that shows that you're unhappy in the present. The person that's always saying, well, I know kids say, when I get out of high school, then I'll be happy, you know? When I get to college, then I'll be free. Then they get to college, they see all the work, they say, oh, when I get into business, I start making money. Then when they start making money and they're making a living, they say, oh boy, I'll be happy when I make my first million. When they make the first million, you know what I mean? It goes on and on and on. They're never happy. They're living totally in the future. Same thing with the extreme religions and all the other religions besides Judaism. What they live for is the world to come. Why? Because they're really unhappy here. They live with their conflicts, and that's the only thing that satisfies them, that after death they'll have the world to come. So they won't have this unhappiness. But they never really appreciate God's world, which is the present right here and now. It's a beautiful, wonderful world that the person could really enjoy. And it's a great thing. You're enjoying God's world. What's wrong with that? There was an observation made that it's very hard to imagine a life without conflict. I mean, we live in a world without conflict. I was one time speaking to a very righteous person, and he told me that sometimes when he speaks to other people, he has to remember back when he had those emotions. In other words, to him, he's in a totally... In other words, we really live in two different worlds. One world is... In other words, a person can only live in the framework of his emotions and those things which motivate you. That's the real you. In other words, the decision maker in the human being defines the human. That which makes decisions. That really defines the human. Now, if we're guided by emotions, so that's who we are. That's our motivators. But the righteous have undone all those incorrect motivations, and they've worked out a motivation based on truth and reality. Therefore, they're a different person. So if they want to somehow relate to a person, they have to, a regular person, or we would call a normal person, is they have to remember back to those feelings to try to understand how this person is operating. The second half of verse 6 says, and the mouth of the righteous will save them. Okay? Who is the them? Okay. Now, the righteous know how to protect themselves. So they are basically protected. But however, the public, you see, doesn't know what we call mediocrity. They don't know how to protect themselves. Therefore, the mouth of the righteous, since the verse 5 said they're totally involved in justice, so they try to help the people that are caught up in these problems and they don't know how to get out of it themselves, so they get involved in justice and they try to help these people that were caught by the wicked, that the wicked people are either trying to trick them out of money or trying to murder them. They try to advise them and help them to get out of their problems. It is definitely somebody else, not the righteous. The result of the wicked is that they are no more. The reason is that they just say they are no more. Why don't they say they're destroyed, they're murdered? The answer is that the wicked, as they move away from reality, then reality has to destroy them. Reality itself will destroy them. Either they'll weaken themselves by going far away from reality, like Hitler. He was at the very end, he was sending out troops that didn't exist anymore. In other words, as he made his decisions, if you follow through his history, kept getting further and further away from reality. He wasn't dealing with reality slowly but surely, and he was making decisions based on basically power, that I have the power to pull through. So therefore, he just forced through this ideas. So his decisions became further and further away from reality, and as he became further and further away from reality, he became very weakened until he just falls. You see? In other words, he falls under the weight of his own lack of truth and reality, and his distance from, and his being very distant from reality. Person that doesn't make rational decisions, at a certain point, they're going to make a decision in reality that they're going to have to be destroyed, that they're going to have to fail. They actually destroy themselves. There was the head of a mafia, I don't remember his name, from Philadelphia. They said that because he always was a very successful mafia leader, but however every time somebody disobeyed him, he would kill him. And in other words, it wasn't the police that destroyed the mafia in Philadelphia, but the head of the mafia destroyed the mafia in Philadelphia. And he literally destroyed the mafia in Philadelphia, because as he started going away from reality, he couldn't work with anybody. Until he didn't have anybody to work with, and he just destroyed him, the people around him, and he destroyed himself. If a person has all these desires, let's say a Hitler or a mafia person, he has the desires for these things, but he doesn't carry it out. And the answer is that's mediocrity. See, mediocrity will not have the failure of the wicked, but their success and failure is dependent totally on their society. If their society, like the United States, when it started out, it was very successful, because since it was to exist, you had to be practical. So therefore, practically, they were very successful. But now that they have all that success, there's no more practicality, so all their crazy emotions are starting to be able to be carried out, and they're starting to live in a world of fantasy. And slowly but surely, it's disintegrating, because they're living in a world of fantasy. They're not living in reality anymore. And at a certain point, they're just going to break down. That's what also happened in Rome, that a bunch of barbarians at the end just destroyed Rome. How? Because at the beginning, when Rome was somehow attached to reality for practical reasons, so they were successful. But as their success, as they didn't need the practicality anymore, and since they're not thinking rationally, so they don't live a practical life because of rationale, so then they start living basically according to their emotions. Then under the weight of their emotions, then any little piece of reality just destroys them. In the case of Rome, a bunch of barbarians that were not very strong just broke them down. That's it, because they couldn't protect themselves anymore. That's why mediocrity doesn't have the failure of the wicked. They're just totally controlled by the society around them. And therefore, their success or failure is dependent on when they were born, what generation they lived on. They lived in a more successful generation, so they were successful. They lived in a society that was failing, they failed. But they don't have control over their destiny. Their destiny is basically based on society around them, because they never really made a decision. And become the righteous or wicked, they have to have made a decision in their life, and they both search for a philosophy of life. One is based on truth and justice, and the other is based on his own desires for power and money. Mediocrity never made a decision. Mediocrity just doesn't make decisions. There are some people that make a decision to go from one society to another society. That is not the decision what we're talking about. We're talking about where you think it through and you make a decision despite society. You don't just join a society, you make it because you see it's the truth. Or if it's evil, then you feel that this is the right way. But it's a decision. But however, mediocrity just is drawn either to one society or to another society, but they never really made their own decision. So far from reality, it just needs the correct situation for him. He will destroy himself because he goes further away. He's acting totally against reality, so he has to fail. So there is a progression. While on the side of the righteous start out with the thoughts of justice, and then as the situation warrants, then they carry out their justice. And those people that stick to them will be successful. Okay. All right, the next observation is that there are two paths. In other words, it's basically the same thing, but there are two paths that lead in two separate directions. One, it starts out with thoughts, and the two thoughts lead to two totally different lives. The verse is talking to mediocrity, and the verse is saying that you really have two paths in front of you. In other words, before you actually make the decision, a person should recognize that it's two paths that he has to make a choice in, and that is the choice of the righteous, that he starts moving in the direction of the righteous, or he starts moving in the direction of evil. And meanwhile, his first decision should be, a correct decision according to verse, would be to make a decision to stick by the righteous, to have a security and gain his knowledge as you move in the direction of the righteous. What I think I'm saying is that there's really two possible ways of looking at it. Either it's looking at it that mediocrity, a person that hasn't made a decision should make a decision, and therefore it's showing the two possibilities and the two possible consequences of those two lives. Or the subject is advising you if you are mediocrity and you want to make a decision, what is the best way of protecting yourself? In other words, if I have to protect myself, am I be more protected by the wicked, because they seem to have the power, and I want to turn towards them, Or should I go for my protection to the righteous who have the knowledge? In both possibilities, it's a decision. In other words, there's two possible decisions. There's one possible decision is to become the righteous, or become the wicked, or there's another decision who to stick to for protection, to protect myself. But it is a decision to make a decision to stick by the righteous or stick by the wicked. First of all, I'd like to go back to one point about the difference between the tzaddik and the rasha, the righteous and the wicked. The righteous person is a person that enjoys what he does. He enjoys his studies, you see. But as a side point, he has to prepare practically. So when he thinks about the future, it's only insofar as his practical life to see where he has to, like, for instance, making money. That's practical, you see. So he has to make money because it's practical. How much money should he make? And that he has to think about the future, you see. But however, really, the rest of his life he spends in the present. He does that which he enjoys. He enjoys the study of Torah, you see. While the wicked, on the other hand, they constantly are making money. Let's take the person that's greedy. He never enjoys it because he's constantly making it and putting it away. However, every once in a while, as a side point, he'll go out and enjoy himself. He'll go to a movie. He'll go to a nightclub or whatever else he does in his spare time, you see. So therefore, the essence of the wicked are always in the future. But however, the pleasures of the present are rare. While the righteous live a life of pleasure, what they enjoy the most, namely study, and insofar as the future is concerned, it's rare. They have to deal with it. They have to deal with the practical, how much they have to deal with it, so they deal with it, you see? But basically, their essence is in the present. So you see, the wicked really don't have, you know, in other words, many times we're jealous of the wicked, but if you really stop and look at their life, it's only a facade, but it's not really, really a good life. Besides the consequences, we're not talking about the consequences of the wicked. That's a separate point. I'm just talking about in the present, okay? The last question that we have to take care of is when we see the righteous, we look at the people around us and we don't see the righteous are that successful, while the wicked seem to be more successful. Okay? So the question is, when we read the verse and we see that the wicked are turned over and they don't exist anymore, where anybody that clings to the righteous stand, the question is, where do you see this? You realize that through the study of Proverbs, you will see that there are, according to Torah, the ultimate righteous person, there aren't too many. That's first of all. Okay, the breed called righteous person, or that category called righteous, is not a large quantity in that category. Maimonides, when he talks about, he was talking about an understanding of Medrash. Medrash are the legends that are written in the Torah. They have crazy stories that the Torah writes about. And he says there are three categories that approaches legends. One is people that read it and accept it literally, and they say, look how great the Torah is. Says then there's another group called what he would call pseudo-intellectuals. And he says they look at these same midrashim and say, look how crazy the Torah is. Look how crazy our sages are, what they write such crazy things. And then he says there's a third group. He says that are so small that you wouldn't be able to call it a group, except you categorize it like you would categorize the sun. Even though there's only one sun, but you have a different category for it. It's a separate category how it relates to Earth. So it's the same thing with this small group. It is so small that it's hard to call a group. Now, if you see, now we're studying through Proverbs, but to actually live the life totally, 100%, there is a very, very small group of people. So the thing is, when you look around you and people say, why does bad things happen to good people, that is understandable because they don't live the life of Proverbs and they don't know how to protect themselves and they do crazy things and they cause their own, most of the times they cause their own problems. Okay? Now the only time that you do see, now the Ramban, Nachmanides, says, that a righteous person, that a bad things happen to a righteous person is a rarity. He says, but it's a, but it does happen. So therefore, if there is a question of why bad things happen to the righteous, you have to understand it's basically a philosophical problem, why God does things to good people. And why sometimes you see a righteous person that's successful, that's also a rarity. You see? That is the book of Job. The book of Job deals with that problem, that rare problem. However, the righteous that truly live with the within the life of and the book of Proverbs is talking about the most of the cases, and the majority of cases, where the decision is based on the mind of the person and how the person makes decisions in the world of reality, he will be successful. There are certain other factors that sometimes that you can't take in consideration, that you just don't realize. There's certain things that it's impossible to recognize. Mount St. Helens, you're hiking on Mount St. Helens and it blows without any warning. I mean, that you can't figure on. But however, insofar as Proverbs is concerned, Proverbs is dealing with the righteous. Insofar as the information he has, he will be successful. Now also, even the righteous, we don't hold from saints. So therefore, even the righteous will make mistakes. You find like by Jacob, the way he raised Joseph. So because of he bought him a coat, because of his love for Joseph. So he brought out the ego in Joseph, and which brought out the jealousy, and also brought out the jealousy of the siblings. And so therefore he had his consequences. Same thing with Moses when he hit the rock instead of speaking to the rock. So therefore he paid his consequences. Those in these rare cases that they do make errors. I mean, because we're human. But you have to understand it's a very, very rare case. And we one time had a proverb that said that that if you see that the righteous are punished, and it's the rare case that they make a mistake, and so you see that they get their consequences. So the thing is that how much more so the wicked, that they constantly don't live in line with the truth, so how much more so are they going to face the consequences? That's what the book of Proverbs is. The book of Proverbs is the righteous and the wicked making decisions about the life around them. And the thing is the righteous, since they're, it's the same thing like saying, let's say, for instance, a doctor makes a decision and a plain person decides to make a decision about medicine. Plain person is going to make a decision, he's going to destroy himself. The doctor, they do make mistakes, but the probability is that they will be more successful. And the same thing with any scientist. Now, Proverbs is the science of life. Therefore, a person that is really a scientist that knows it thoroughly, plus lives according to it, that person will either very rarely or never make a mistake. And therefore, insofar as the information that he has, he will have a successful life. However, there's factors that he's not aware of. In that case, then he can't help it. Then it's not his fault. Okay? That is why the Proverbs always talks about that he will be 100% successful insofar as his decision, he was right. But there's a very, very rare case where beyond his control that the righteous will fail because it's beyond their control. It's beyond their knowledge. So therefore they can't... And Job deals with that problem. That's not our. That's not really the subject of Proverbs, that rare case. The subject of Proverbs is teach you how to get the best out of life and to protect yourself against the harms of life so that you should have the best possible life, but it can't protect you against outside influences that's beyond your knowledge, outside influences which is beyond your knowledge. That's added a realm of Proverbs. Proverbs is not talking about that. That has to do with your relationship to God, okay, and how God relates to you. That's a separate problem. It has nothing to do with your decision-making. The question was made that the truly wicked, that the Torah usually talks about, and the truly righteous is a rare group. Those people that really make a decision on their own, whether the decision is made from the mind or whether the decision is made from the emotions, that they truly make a decision about their life. But however, the masses and most of the people do not make any decisions. They simply follow society. And usually they'll follow one of these two groups of people. The question is, who was the book of Proverbs written for? The truth is, the book of Proverbs was written for everybody. In other words, if you are one of those people that are truly going to make a decision in life, so then we're going to try and help you make a decision towards righteousness. And if you're the type of people that follow the masses, and let's say you were raised in a place of study, and you study Proverbs, so it will help you pull out of the mediocrity of the masses and help you put your energy and to reach the higher level of really actually making a decision where you see that the truth is the right way and you follow the truth despite the society around you and you just move on ahead, you see? So the Proverbs was really written for everybody. A person that's mediocrity doesn't mean he has to stay there. He could pull himself up and pull himself out of that area. So therefore, the book of Proverbs, and according to King Solomon himself in his introduction, actually says that it's written for the beginner, and it's written for the wise. He says the wise could learn things from this. In other words, a lot of the knowledge they will have, and they will have thought of on their own if they, without reading the book, they would have realized just from the observations the truth around them. But however, they'll have gain, and they will gain from this book. And he says also, it was written for the beginner, so to help the beginner get started in the world of the science of life. And to help him with science in general, like to really define the way he wrote the book, and then two, to help him in the particular science of life, to help him have the best possible life that a human being could have. The question is, what is the book of Proverbs different from Ecclesiastes, which were both written by King Solomon? Now, the thing is that the book of Proverbs was written basically for actions, how to protect yourself from the future. Person has a desire. Person basically there's two things. There's every human being has a desire for the most pleasure, and to avoid pain. This is what this is in Sadyagon's introduction to Proverbs. Now he says there's the emotional view of immediate pleasure and the avoidance of pain, and then there's the intellectual view, the wisdom, looking into the future with wisdom and knowledge of pain and pleasure. So therefore, the thing is that the immediate versus the future, where where you have to protect yourself from the consequences. The wicked go according to the immediate desires, while the righteous think about it, and even though they have a desire for right now, they live according to their wisdom, which they can't experience now, but they realize in the future how it's going to be. So they base it based on their wisdom. That's basically the book of Proverbs. However, the book of Ecclesiastes deals... the book looks like it's dealing with the physical world, you see. And so, therefore, a lot of people look at it and say, well, the whole physical world is nothing, and therefore the only real thing is to work for the world to come. That is really not true. It's not talking about that, because the truth is that there's nothing in the physical world that's good or bad. Everything is good or bad. It's only how the human uses it that makes it good or bad. Right? So therefore, the thing is that what Ecclesiastes is talking about is the different motives, what motivates you to do actions. What he's talking about is all the incorrect motives, even for the study of Torah. He says the person that wants wisdom is a vanity, you see? So he says, the truth is that if you desire wisdom because you want grandeur or greatness, that's vanity. That's really vanity, you see? So therefore, that's really nothingness. It's really absolutely nothing. However, you must have learning and study for the correct motive. You see, you must get it for the correct motive, not the incorrect motive. So therefore, the thing is that the book of Proverbs is for actions, how to protect yourself in the physical world based on your actions, while the book of Ecclesiastes is based on your motives and how to start dealing with your motives and to analyze your motives and to recognize, to go through all the motives that are possible and to undo all the false motives to help you move towards the correct motive. Right, we're doing verse 8, and it says, a man should be praised, a man is praiseworthy according to his intelligence, and a distorted heart despised. When it says intelligence, does it mean IQ, ability? Does it mean intelligence about physics, science, or does it mean intelligence about book knowledge, just the facts? I mean, what does it mean by intelligence? And as we never saw so far, I mean, but usually they don't use the word intelligence. Okay? Now, why did he suddenly use the word intelligence? Okay. The question is what is it praiseworthy? Is it praised by other people, or is there some other thing? Now, the truth is that there are two approaches to analyze praiseworthy. One is inherently, objectively, he is praiseworthy. Or two, he is praiseworthy from people. Okay? In other words, he's praised by people. So we're going to approach it from the fact that it's objectively praiseworthy. The thing is that when you analyze the verses, there are sometimes two ways of interpreting the verse, meaning that they're two separate facts. If there are two separate facts, or there's two ways of reading or translating the verse, then you must take each one separately and analyze each. It's like having two separate facts, and each fact has to be analyzed separately. The question is, did King Solomon have both these ideas in mind, or no? I mean, just that's the way we're interpreting it, that we have two possibilities. The thing is that definitely King Solomon only had one idea in mind. When he wrote the book, he had one idea in mind. But however, when interpreting the Torah, we have to interpret it according to the way we see it, what makes sense. Sometimes the commentaries themselves write two possibilities because they're not sure in their mind which one is correct. when they only write one possibility, then that's the way they see the verse. They see the verse 100% that it's that way. It's not that they disagree with the ideas of the others. In most cases where there is a disagreement between the commentaries, usually they agree with the idea. What they disagree with is whether the verse is saying that. But however, at a certain point, the person sees the, when he's reading the verse, to his mind, one is smoothest either in words or in ideas. In other words, the idea smoothest to the fits into these words the best. And so once you see it that way, then you must accept the verse that way. But however, if you feel you both are possibilities and you don't see one over the other, that's when the commentaries write both interpretations. Okay? Is that if a person is... Does the person feel any, that he feels great about this? Definitely that would be, we wouldn't call him an intelligent person if he felt that he was great. That would be a foolish person. So the thing is that objectively there are certain things worthwhile and they are praiseworthy. You see what I mean? There's objectively, it's objectively praiseworthy. This is just the opposite of praiseworthy. So therefore, however we define praiseworthy, then that will be, the opposite will be despised. This is heart. What does heart mean? Heart, according to the Ibn Ezra in Torah, means intelligence. Of course, heart is a metaphor for the source of the physical. And so the becomes a metaphor for the idea of that the mental is the source of everything. Okay? The Meiri says that there are four types of perfection in a human being. Okay? The first is furthest away from the human being, and that is perfection in acquisition. Wealthy person, beautiful home. Okay? The second is perfection of the body, which is health, strength, beauty. He's healthy, that all his parts work well. That's the second. It's closer to the person, because it's his physical body. It's closer to who the human is. The first one was the acquisition. Things that is not a part of you, but what you own. Okay? So there's a certain level which we call a perfected, that he has wealth, he has enough to take care of all his needs and satisfy his desires. Okay? That's a type of perfection. You have that, you have a better life. You don't have to worry about if something goes wrong with your car and you're going to have to worry about it's not in the budget, that's not perfection. But if you have your needs and all your needs are satisfied, and if something comes up, in the physical world, so that's a certain type of perfection. Okay? That's what the Miri says. Second is the body. There's a certain strength when you exercise, and a certain enjoyment, and there's handsomeness, and there's affection of the all the parts. Everything works correctly. It's a certain perfection. That's the perfection of the body. The third is perfection of your personality. That's basically a lot which Proverbs has to do with, and chapters of the Father. The Pirkei Avos, that has to do with the perfection of your personality traits and how it affects your thinking and how it harms you in different ways. The highest level of perfection, and that which brings you close to God, is the perfection of the mind. Doesn't mean, in the question, it doesn't mean that which you're born with, but the studies that you study, the knowledge of science, the knowledge of God, this type of science, That is the highest level of perfection. Okay, is there any questions? Who's doing the praising, okay? The thing is that, in other words, for a human being to have the best possible life, the truth is he needs all these four perfections. He needs all four. But the question is, which is the ultimate purpose, objectively? When we say praiseworthy, we mean objectively what is best, what is the highest level for the human being. The highest level for the human being is the perfected mind, where he's trained and think in all the different sciences and all the different subjects, and the knowledge of God, the knowledge of halacha, all different areas, his mind is perfected. In fact, the way to reach prophecy is when all your energy is turned towards knowledge. When all your energy is turned towards knowledge, then you must get prophecy. So you see that the mind, that perfection of the mind and its application in thought and ideas, that is the highest level of a human being. By praiseworthy, there are four perfections which a human being could have, and they're good. We're not talking about where you use them incorrectly. You use them correctly, they're all good. But however, the ultimate perfection is the perfection of the mind. That's the essence of the human being, and it's the purpose of the human being. So objectively, what is best for the human being? There are different benefits that the human being could have that are good for the human being. I mean, if you have money, practically money is a beneficial thing. And if you have a healthy body and it's a good, it's a benefit. And exercise is beneficial physically and psychologically. They're good things. If you perfect your emotions, it means you're not in conflict, and it means that it'll help your thinking and help you think straight and not make errors in your thinking. But those things are all preparations that make life easier for the mind to work. But the ultimate perfection of the human being is the ideas that he thinks. There is a book called The Duties of the Heart by Bachya Ibn Pakuda. And in his introduction, he writes that there is the actions, like the halacha that we're obligated to do and how we operate in everyday life, you see. But however, then there's duties of the heart. By duties of the heart, he means those ideas which we must have, there's no action in it. There's absolutely no action. The perfection is just getting the idea straight. Yeah, that's it, getting the idea correct. That's the whole thing. That's the whole, and then he says, that's duties of the heart. That's what he's saying. Which you're obligated, ideas which a human being is obligated to have. Okay? And that's what this verse is talking about. It's talking about the perfection of the mind. In other words, the thoughts and ideas that you see correctly, objectively, you see these ideas that they must be correct. And you see them correct. So then that is the highest level of perfection, when you perfected that part of you. The question of why it uses the word intelligence here. Most of the book of Proverbs is talking about how to act and the different emotions which affect your actions. And it's talking about the third level of perfection, of making sure your emotions don't make any errors. But however, he does say, however, you have to understand that the highest level of perfection is the knowledge itself. Looked at it from the physical world, how the human being is different from any other animal is that the human being has a mind. And when he uses that mind and intelligence, that person has fulfilled the ultimate of the human being. The problem with emotions and why we work on emotions so much is not so much for happiness, even though it will give us happiness. That's a side effect to happiness. But the ultimate objective is that it should remove our emotions so we shouldn't think incorrectly. In fact, in the physical world, when we make errors in the physical world, it shows that we're thinking incorrectly. And therefore, our emotions are telling us how to operate, and we're not operating correctly. But the ultimate is the thinking itself, is the decision-making part of the human being, and the ideas that the person sees. These ideas are which make the human being what he is. That's what he is. In other words, many people say, well, what's my purpose on life? To be a human being. What's a human being? What does he have different than any other animal? What's his essence? It's to think. So therefore, when he thinks, he's fulfilling his ultimate objective and purpose, and then the organism will be working perfectly, and then he will be happy. That's a result of living the correct life. So happiness is not the motive for learning. It's a result of learning. But however, the ultimate purpose of learning is the love of learning. The question is, in Jeremiah 9, verse 22, it says that you should not praise a wise man for his wisdom, and you should not praise a strong man for his strength, and you should not praise a rich man for his wealth. Okay? Now, over here, it's saying that it is praiseworthy for a man's wisdom, meaning the ideas itself, his intelligence, meaning the thoughts and ideas itself. So the question is a contradiction between Proverbs and Jeremiah. That some people study Torah, and especially a beginner, he must, until the ideas of Torah affect him. He must study Torah for a incorrect motive, okay? And it could be ego, it could be competition, it could be the desire to destroy others, which is a very bad motive. Because it's a destructive motive. Or it could be the image of being a wise person. There are many different reasons, or religious reasons. There's many different reasons why a person studies Torah. Okay, all these are incorrect. And Maimonides even says for the desire to reach the world to come, that's an incorrect motive. Okay? The thing is that there are two reasons for using an object. Either you use it for what it was, for inherently what it was made for, or you do not use it inherently for what it's made for. In other words, for instance, a car was made for travel, but a lot of people use it just for ego gratification. They have to get a fancy car to make it fancy, and they're really interested in the ego gratification. Essentially, a car is simply a means of getting you from one place to another. People change its essence. You say, or use it for a different thing. Okay? Now, the same thing with the mind. The mind was made for the search for truth. And naturally, every human being, they didn't have all these other emotions, they would naturally search for truth. Okay? But however, because of all the other emotions that we have, so therefore, we use study for our personal gain. So therefore, since we use it for our personal gain, that is not what we're talking about, the intelligence, you see. If the motive is incorrect, then that is not what the verse is talking about. Okay? What we're talking about is intelligence, simply because of the desire to see the truth. There is a desire to see truth, and we can see it as we study and become more objective. That desire can be brought forth, and the others fall by the wayside. You see? Now that's really the purpose of Proverbs and Ethics of the Fathers. That its purpose is to help you start undoing the emotions that distort your view and your motive. First of all, it distorts your views, and secondly, it distorts the very motive and purpose of ideas. The purpose of ideas is there's something in the human being which makes him desire, which is part of his very soul, which makes him desire to see truth. And what you have to do is start undoing all the emotions, all that part of you that tries to distort it, to start undoing it and to start seeing the truth itself. And when you see the truth totally, when your desire for truth is simply for the purpose of truth, that is when you are praiseworthy. But if you study just for greatness and for publicity or to be known, then that is not praiseworthy. That is not yet praiseworthy. That is like a person that desires beauty. He wants to be handsome so that people should look at him. You see, that's the first level, where there's a perfection, not because it's a practical thing, but it's a perfection for self-aggrandizement. You see, so therefore, that is not praiseworthy. What praiseworthy is when your very motive for studying, then it doesn't matter the quantity of knowledge, it's really the quality, how you relate to the knowledge, that becomes that's really what is praiseworthy. A medrash which says that if a person has a chance to enjoy a physical pleasure and he doesn't, so then he loses his portion in the world to come. Okay? Now the question is, that is totally contrary to the philosophy of Judaism. In fact, it's definitely contrary to this very verse that we're saying. Okay? But the answer, what Dan Medrash is talking about, is certain people learn because, let's say, for instance, you were raised in a home of study, and you study because you have a conscience and you're driven to study, you see? And because of that personality, you can't enjoy life. You can't enjoy things that is not incorrect to enjoy. You enjoy a piece of fruit, you enjoy something sweet, you're not driven towards it. You enjoy exercise. There's physical things that a person can enjoy. You see? And the thing is, if you don't allow yourself to enjoy it, but you're driven by a certain ethic of responsibility and constantly driven, you see, that is good as an incorrect motive to start out with. But however, ultimately, that is not the correct motive. A person has to enjoy his studies. That's the way he gets to relate to it inherently. So therefore, if a person doesn't enjoy, if he cannot allow himself to enjoy the physical world, you see, then it's impossible for him to enjoy study. So therefore, that person, what it means, he doesn't get the world to come, it means that he's not studying for the correct purpose. And therefore, his studies are of no value insofar as Torah is concerned. And so, therefore, he has lost out on this verse. This verse is saying that you relate directly to the knowledge of Torah. The way a person truly relates to a thing is if he really enjoys it. That which he enjoys, that draws him. His energy is drawn it's closer to his drive, to his desire. And so therefore, when learning becomes a person has to be able to allow himself to enjoy life, and then when he enjoys it, then he's able to enjoy his studies, then it becomes his essence. You see? Then it becomes part of his essence, because he has more energy. His basic energy, his basic drive is towards that which he enjoys. And once he allows himself to enjoy it, and then he enjoy life, then he enjoys the study. See, the highest level of a human being, where he loves study so much that he gives up the other pleasures for the greater pleasure of study, because he's just drawn to learn study more than anything else. So therefore, the highest level of a human being, where he's constantly studying because of his love of learning, not because he's driven by competition or some other emotion or the desire to get to the world to come, because those will not allow him to enjoy the world, because how could he stop to enjoy the world? He has to fulfill these drives. In other words, when we're dealing with the motive, we must, what we're searching for is the object is to relate to the activity and to enjoy the activity over the result. All other areas is the activity becomes unimportant, but the result is important. You see, that's always incorrect motive. Like, I want to be a wise person. That's an object. That's not, so I don't enjoy the activity, I just want to reach that objective. Or I want to reach the world to come. So that becomes the objective, but I don't relate the activity. What we're saying, the main drive, the true purpose is relating to the activity and the enjoyment of the activity of study. That becomes the main important thing. Person searches this way, and he's really honest, then it's impossible not to find God. That's an impossibility. A person can only live by that which motivates him. You can't live by anything else except that which motivates you. Now, when you study this verse, now this is, just studying it once is not going to suddenly change your life. So therefore, you just can't change over. You can't change overnight. It's the study itself. As the study itself starts affecting your emotions, that your motive starts changing. You can't force it. If you try to force it to change, so then you're a person that's dictated by a certain image, by the result. So therefore, the way to relate to the verse is to enjoy the verse and review it. And as long as you enjoy it, and then you'll take another verse, and as you start seeing it and enjoying it and relating to it, slowly but surely your emotions will change over, and then your motive, what motivates you, you'll be a different person, because a person is that which motivates them. That's really the essence of the person, that which motivates them, who you are. But that can only come about, it could take years of study where you use the incorrect motive, and slowly but surely the correct motive takes its place. It's a natural result. It's not a forced thing. It comes as a result of your studies. The second half of the verse is talking about a distorted mind. What it means is that a person has a lot of knowledge. The distortion is in the motive, that he's motivated by something other than the truth.